The next case is 05216 and 412, State of Ohio versus Robert Kreischer. Justice Resnick has recused herself in this case, and we're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Donald Ford, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 11th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Ford. Mr. Wilford.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. I don't know if my voice will hold out for 10 minutes, but I will do my best. Before the Court is a question involving the interpretation of two interlocking statutes. For the purpose of clarification, I will refer in the present tense to former version of 2929.18A1, which I will call the restitution statute, and in the present tense to the former version of 2929.01 subsection M, which I will refer to as the economic loss statute. Any references to current or prior law will be referenced as such. By way of overview of the restitution statute, it comprises one paragraph, seven sentences in all. Although the language can seem dense and largely impenetrable, the structure actually has a simplicity that I think is revealing. The first sentence provides a broad statement of overarching purpose of the financial sanction of restitution. Quote, the court may impose restitution by the offender to the victim of the offender's crime in an amount based on the victim's economic loss, in an amount based on the victim's economic loss. I think it is also noteworthy that this last sentence is practically the only part of the statute that still survives under current law. The second sentence of the statute is largely mechanical. It provides who payments, restitution payments should be made to, the probation department, the clerk of courts, some other agency designated by the court. And then it provides an exception. And the exception is that payments can be made to third parties for payments made to or on behalf of the victim based on the victim's economic loss. Now, I think a noteworthy point here is that exception is to the sentence of who payments are to be made. It's not an exception to the first sentence, which is the amount of the victim's economic loss. The third sentence simply establishes preferences for public third parties rather than private third parties. The fourth sentence provides that if there is no public third party, then a private third party should be repaid for payments made to or on behalf of the victim's economic loss.
If you maintain that payment under the new statute only goes to the victim, then what is the need for any disbursement phrase about third parties? They aren't, under your theory, owed anything.
Third parties can be owed something. They just can't be owed something that, that's been paid which displaces the economic loss suffered by the victim. For example, if in the Martin case, out of the 4th District, the vandalism had caused them to have to evacuate the residence, and if they'd gone to a hotel and family members had paid for the hotel bill with an expectation of being repaid when they could be, that would still be financial loss suffered by the victim, that which could be recovered and could be directly paid to whoever it was who put it up.
And if a victim is injured and goes to hospital and gets treatment and has a bill, why is that not his economic loss? Why does a defendant benefit from a contract that he may have or an employee benefit that he may have that has nothing to do with the defendant?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, if there were no contract for insurance here, the appellant would owe every dollar that the court below entered against him.
So does he get a windfall because somebody has insurance?
Hardly. In fact, that's one of the points where the Court of Appeals strayed in this case. The appellant didn't escape or was exempt from no liability. Blue Cross or Blue Shield had every right to go into court to recover if they have a right to. The victim would have a right to bring a lawsuit, including his medical expenses, which are figured in. So just by not being part of restitution doesn't mean that the offender is exempt at all. I do believe the old legal doctrine of you take your victim as you find him has some application here. And that application is under the restitution statute, you take the victim as you find him.
So if you have a victim who has no insurance, you have a higher cost. If you happen to have a victim that has insurance, I mean, doesn't this send a message to criminal defendants to be sure that they prey on people that have insurance? I mean, that's kind of a mixed message.
Your Honor, hardly, and I don't think that comes into the punch that was thrown here didn't have anything to do about whether the victim had insurance or not. It just doesn't work that way. But again, the offender is not exempt from liability just because it's not addressed in the restitution order of the court. And remember, restitution is made at the time of sentencing. If the defendant's in jail, that may be 3 to 6 minutes, or 3 to 6, 3 to 6 months after the offense was committed. If he's out of jail, it may be 6 months to a year. A lot of times, these things aren't settled by that time.
Then do we really need to decide what is economic loss, whether it's, if it's incurred by the victim, is it economic loss? And if it's paid by a carrier, it's not economic loss? Is that what we need to decide to resolve this issue?
Well, Your Honor, I think economic loss, first of all, is defined by statute and it is what it is. I do believe you have to see whether the order of the court below had anything to do with economic loss of this victim. And if the victim was not billed for it and did not pay anything towards it, I don't see how under the economic loss statute, because there's no economic detriment. That's what it all revolves around. And that is why under the restitution statute, you have to take the victim as you find him.
Part of your argumentation, counsel, as I understand it, is a referencing both to the statutory language in force at the time in this case and prospectively to collateral exercises that may be undertaken. Isn't there kind of a policy of legislative intent that restitution in itself bring matters to a closure?
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer to that is yes, but the purpose of restitution is not to make the whole world whole. The purpose of the restitution statute, if you look at that first sentence of this statute, the purpose of the restitution statute is to make all the victims of the world whole. Now, that means some people can come in under this statute and some people can't, but everybody still has full resort to the courts for civil redress of their damages. So I don't think we can bring all closure by putting all, total reliance on the restitution sanction, and that may be very well why the General Assembly decided to gut that statute, and all of the court decisions, or the greater weight of the court decisions, including the 11th District, which
still in Ohio, go ahead.
Well, you did a stutter stance on this issue in the 11th District, I think, but those were all court decisions which I believe counsel for the appellee is going to say were correctly decided. I would like to talk about State versus Martin, because that is the leading case. It's the only reported case, and I think it's the case that caused the erroneous momentum to build on that side of this issue. The facts are very simple. Vandalism and burglary caused damages. Homeowner's insurance paid for the damages, paid the homeowner, and the Court of Appeals upheld the trial court's award of $10,000 to the homeowner. A victim. We believe Martin was wrongly decided. The very purpose of insurance is to protect the victim or the beneficiary against economic detriment, and to the extent the insurance does that, it displaces economic loss of the victim. And therefore, under the first sentence of the restitution statute, there is no basis for a restitution order. Our position here is, if there is no economic detriment to the victim, there can be no economic loss under the statutory language, and therefore there can be no basis for a restitution order under the first sentence of the restitution statute. I don't think we can ignore reality that the current law has purged all third-party payment arrangements under this statute. In fact, it has more emphatically embraced that first sentence of the former version of the restitution statute, which says the amount shall be based on the victim's economic loss. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilford. Mr. Flout.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The position of the state in this matter that in order to reconcile the language of 2929.18a1 and the definition of economic loss, there must be a requirement that third parties be reimbursed for any losses they paid on behalf of a victim. Towards the end of 2929.18a1, the legislature refers to a requirement that the court not make an offender reimburse an insurance company for economic loss they paid on behalf of the offender, and that has been interpreted to mean that if the offender is insured, then that is not part of the restitution order. And I don't think the legislature would have included that language if they did not intend for an insurer of the victim to be reimbursed for any expenses that they have paid on behalf of the victim. It seems that the logical and proper public policy in this matter would be to require a criminal defendant to reimburse all of those who paid for the losses which a victim has suffered, whether it be through a contract of insurance, whether it be the state's victim of crime compensation fund, whether it be a family member or a generous neighbor. To the extent it can be done, the issues of restitution should be dealt with within the criminal court system rather than requiring all third parties to initiate a civil action in an attempt to recover the expenses that they have paid on behalf of a victim.
But the amendment to the statute deletes reference to all third parties.
Yes, it does.
So what do we glean from that?
Well,
we used to have it, now we don't have it. It was there while this case arose. Now it's not there. Are we writing a rule of law for this case or for
this case was decided under the former statute. That's what was in effect at that time, Your Honor.
I understand that, but I think the more global view would be we could look back and try to apply the statute to the facts of this case. That would be fine. But what rule of law do you want the Supreme Court of the state of Ohio to look for and put out for future direction to lawyers and judges?
Your Honor, I think even under the new statute, even though it does not make reference to the payment being made to third parties, I don't think that precludes that. The new statute says who the restitution is to be paid to. Says to the victim in open court or to the adult probation department, to the clerk of courts, or another agency designated by the court. I think that's a mechanism as to who the funds are physically paid to, but my interpretation would be that that does not preclude payments from that agency that receives the funds on to third parties who have paid bills on behalf of the victim or reimbursed the victim.
Well, how can we read into the statute language about a third party that the legislature's read out of it or not included in it or forgot to put into it. Isn't it their problem, not ours? We're a different branch of the government.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. But the court is directed to pay the economic loss of the victim, whatever that may be, the economic detriment suffered by the victim as a result of the offense. And my interpretation of that economic loss would be any losses the victim incurs, no matter who actually pays it.
Okay.
No other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flout. Mr. Wilford, you save 5 minutes.
Thank you.
This is your plan.
Try not to use
most lawyers aren't able to do that. Congratulations.
well, first of all, I don't think their interpretation of the restitution statute saves much, if any, burden on our civil courts, because most of these end up in civil court anyway, as in this case. There were two civil lawsuits filed by the victim in this case. And of course, if Anthem would have wanted to, and there's nothing in the record even to suggest that they have a right of subrogation in this case, but they have never signaled they've never participated in this case whatsoever, but they could have. And the point is, I think the General Assembly realizes that's what the civil courts are for, and that's what we need them for. As far as the public agencies, whether it's the Attorney General's Client Fund, which was involved in this case and successfully so, or child enforcement, those agencies all have their statutory right to pursue the offenders. And so what we're asking the court to hold here doesn't step on their feet whatsoever. And there is no prejudice to them. I'm a little mystified by Appley's position on the public policy, because if I understand it right, what was supposedly sound public policy then is no longer sound public policy now. And I realize that the General Assembly certainly has its right to change its mind, but quite frankly, this has been a work in progress, year in, year out almost. And it seems to me that what the General Assembly has done is try to harmonize what was happening here. I think I will end where I began, which was, I think this court can properly and soundly hold that this revolves around the victim and the victim's economic loss. That's how it's defined by statute. And where there is no economic detriment to the victim, there can be no economic loss pursuant to statute. And if there is no economic loss, as that is defined by the legislature, then there can be no restitution order based on it. That is the holding, I believe, of State versus Miller out of the 6th District. I would ask the court to uphold that position. There's no other further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wilford. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.